Good evening. It's every other Sunday again, and welcome to Sustainability Now. That was a clip from a piece by Snuffy Walden called On the Road to Kansas. And today, we're going to be visiting Kansas, ranging beyond California, where we've been limited before then. My guest today is Professor Jenny Reardon, faculty member in the UCSC Sociology Department and director of the Science and Justice Research Center. Professor Reardon holds a bachelor in science and a biology in BA, a bachelor of science in biology and a BA in political science from the University of Kansas, and a PhD in science and technology studies from Cornell University. She is author most recently of The Postgenomic Condition, Ethics, Justice, Knowledge After the Genome, published in 2017. Today, we're going to talk about her new project, Caring for the Prairie, which, and here I quote, is a project involving biking through the prairies and small towns of Kansas, designed to develop embodied knowledge of the land and to find out more about attitudes towards contemporary U.S. politics from the denizens of the prairies. By talking about how to know and care for the land with her interlocutors, she uncovers layer by layer the interlocking effects of globalization, financialization, and environmental change on how they live their lives. So let's start with the prairie. How did you get onto this project, Jenny?
Well, I guess it was 3 years ago. I was had to teach my large lecture course, Issues and Problems in American Society, starting on January the 8th, 2017. Trump had just been elected. I had put What's the Matter with Kansas on the syllabus. I was pretty sure all of my students from California would know nothing about Kansas, so I thought I would just go back and do a little mini What's the Matter with Kansas tour. This is the Thomas Frank book. Best-selling book. And so I was just going to go to these little towns that he mentioned so I could have some photographs for my PowerPoint. And I went back when I was at the University of Kansas, as you mentioned, my best friend had grown up on her family farm in the Flint Hills of Kansas. And I went back to her farm where she had moved back, and her whole family knew I was coming. I had a long relationship with them, and half her family had voted for Trump and half the family had voted for Clinton and hadn't spoken since, you know, they had really hadn't spoken about it since the election, but they all knew me. They had a 25-year relationship with me, and it was a bitter cold day in Kansas, and they all came in out of the cold and started talking to me, and I didn't say, you know, why did you vote for who you voted for, because that's not kind of what you do in Kansas. You don't ask people who they voted for, but you ask about, you know, why you think in general, you know, what happened, and it got a conversation going, and they all started talking to one another again. And my friend said to me, how did you do that? Like, they haven't talked to each other since the election. And it was by asking really specific questions about them. You know, how do these policies, like, how is the EPA, how are the policies that the EPA is putting down affecting your farm? And really asking them to be specific with me that led to, I think, a good conversation that surprised me. And then I thought, I had started to be a long-distance biker. And I thought, look, there's a lot to learn by actually really sitting and talking to people and listening what they had to say. And I'd already known from previous long-distance biking I had done that biking is a good way to not just know the land, but the people. So I thought, okay, maybe I could bike across Kansas. And I remember saying to my friend, what do you think is more risky, biking from London to Berlin, which I had done, or biking across Kansas? There's like definitely Kansas. But anyway, thus a crazy project started, and it really wasn't, I actually didn't think I was going to be able to do it. But that's how it started.
Well, most of the times people do this kind of field work by car.
Yeah.
So tell us about how this worked.
Well, okay. So if I had done it by car, I don't think you could do this project by car. You know, if I had shown up in a car, I'm sure most of the people I'm talking to would not have talked to me. Part of the thing about a bike is it's sort of a diplomat. It's very much of an anomaly to have someone show up to these little towns in Kansas on a bike. There is something called Bike Across Kansas. that every year happens. And usually people go from the west to the east because the wind blows from the west. And Kansas is actually the call word for the south wind. And the wind usually blows, you know, greater than 20 miles an hour on any given day. So it's only a fool that goes from east to west, which is what I've been doing. And I haven't been biking across so much Kansas so much as I've been going in loops. Thus my fool's persona in the middle of Kansas. But it gets a good conversation going when I show up. And, you know, there was one time when I showed up in this little town of Marion, Kansas, and the person said to me, "How did you end up here in the middle of nowhere?" And I said, "The middle of nowhere, this town, it has Wi-Fi." She had this flatbread pizza place, and she was from, she had come from Germany to Kansas as a immigrant in the 1980s on a sports scholarship. And we launched into a great conversation about immigration policy, et cetera. And that's how these conversations start, you know, so mutual curiosity.
So for those of us who have never been to Kansas, actually, I've been to Kansas.
Did you stop?
I did dissertation research in Abilene at the Eisenhower Library, which was very strange. But that's not, we're not here to talk about me.
Normally, most people have been, when I ask them, have you stopped? They're like, no, passed through. So you actually did stop. That's good.
Yeah. No, I've never actually driven all the way across the state. Mm-hmm. But can you give us a sense of the geography of where you were doing research? Because I think that's kind of important, too.
So there are three sites that I've been focused on, three sites for questions about how knowing and caring for prairie have been at issue in Kansas over actually centuries. The first is the Flint Hills of Kansas. There was an over 100-year debate about whether or not this country should have a national park devoted to tallgrass prairie. George Catlin was the first person who was a painter and a naturalist in the 1800s who first made the suggestion that we should preserve these prairies. They are the iconic American landscape. And then there was an over 100-year debate, which I could talk more about. It's a very interesting story. And then the second site is outside of Emporia, outside of Salina, Kansas, where the Land Institute is, which mm-hmm. was started by Wes Jackson, a geneticist. And from you mentioned the book I just published, before I did anything else, I was in genetics research, and I learned about the work of Wes Jackson when I was in Kansas, trying to figure out how I was going to interweave my genetics and my interest in politics. And I learned about this geneticist, Wes Jackson, who had come back. He had founded one of the first environmental studies programs in the country here in California.
Where?
I think in Sacramento.
Okay.
And then went back to Kansas as part of the Back to the Land movement. Mm-hmm. And his sole key idea was to create a perennial wheatgrass. If the problem of the Dust Bowl had been the plow breaking up the prairie grass and the sod and making it so that the soil blew away, then the answer was, well, don't have the plow, you know, plow up the soil, create a perennial wheatgrass that could just stay planted and you wouldn't need to plow it. And so the Land Institute has become one site for this research and reactions, community reactions to the Land Institute. And then the final site is far western Kansas, which is the land of the Dust Bowl, which in the 1930s, trillions of tons of soil blew away after the plow dug up this land that no one thought this is the Great American Desert,
right,
quote unquote,
yeah.
You know, past the 100th meridian. You weren't supposed to be able, no one was supposed to live here, least of which to actually try to, get agriculture going. They plowed it up. And then as it does in Kansas, you go through periods of drought, years where you have rain and years where you don't. They went through some drought years. Anyway, that land became, as we know, the Dust Bowl, famous moment in American history. But then in the 1940s, they started really pumping oil, which allowed them to pump water, because underneath of that land is the Ogallala Aquifer, the largest underland sea in the world. And with wind, you can pump up water from 20 feet down.
Mm-hmm.
But with carbon power, you can get the water in the Ogallala Aquifer, which is 500 feet down. Mm-hmm. And that's what people did. And that's what brought agriculture back to this land. But now the water's running out again. And so my questions are around what happens when the water runs out. So those are the three sites. And just to say, Kansas, although people think it's flat, it actually goes up 3,000 feet. It's going towards the Rockies.
Mm-hmm.
And it slowly, it's like gently rolling hills. So, it's not flat.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Yeah. So what do people think about what to do, you know, what to do out there?
Well, so, there's lots of responses.
Maybe we should back up for a second, right? Okay. When we read all the time about depopulation in the Great mm-hmm. Plains, right, which must have some impact on the viability of agriculture.
Yes.
And I mean, maybe you can start with that and then, segue into, what do they think can be done or should be done?
So the radio show is called Sustainability Now. And, there's an effort. Well, I was just saying that because the word sustainability, there's an effort in Kansas to create something called sustainable beef. And one of the criteria for sustainable beef, you know how you can get little labels, like they're trying to create a new label. And one of the ways that you would get this label, sustainable beef, is if you have a plan for how your beef operation is going to continue over the generations. So that part of the problem, as you may know, is that there's been consolidation of farms, which one of the biggest insights when I was telling you, I had this conversation with my family, my best friend from college's family when I went back to Kansas, and her uncle who runs the farm, who I have a long relationship with. And I said to her uncle, what are the problems that farmers out here face? We hear about big ag. And he said to me, well, what is big ag? You know, there's no corporation out here taking over. What's happening is you've got larger tractors. You have the technological capacity for less people to farm the land. And so farms have gotten bigger.
Right.
And also as the generations have gone, the youth have not wanted to stay in these little towns. And so depopulation has happened. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of towns, ghost towns, former thriving towns that, very few people live in. They've become places where the only reason to live out there is because you could buy a house for $30,000. There's a lot of poverty in these towns. So part of creating sustainable agriculture industries for some people now is trying to, counteract that, because the argument is, if we have no town, then we have no agriculture. If there's nowhere for people to live, then we're not going to be able to do this. It will not be sustainable. So yes, we have most of these towns have seen declines in populations of between 25% and 50%. I always look at the numbers when I'm going through town. You can look at the census numbers, and it's been a dramatic decrease in a lot of these towns.
Okay, well, let's take a quick break. You're listening to KSQD in Santa Cruz, 90.7 FM, and KSQD.org on the internet. Tune in to KSQD Tuesday mornings at 7 for Climate One, produced by the Commonwealth Club. Climate One is a forum for candid discussion among climate scientists, policymakers, activists, and concerned citizens, with a focus on energy, the economy, and the environment. Climate One airs Tuesday morning at 7 and alternate Mondays at 6 p.m. here on KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. So this is Sustainability Now. I'm speaking with Professor Jenny Reardon from UCSC Sociology Department, and we're talking about Kansas. So Jenny was just telling us about the agricultural consolidation and depopulation across the state, right? Mm-hmm. That's something that's happening around the world, is that as farms acquire more technology, it becomes more expensive to operate, scale becomes important. And mm-hmm. so the poor farmers lose out. This is actually the story of the grapes of wrath.
Mm-hmm.
That although it's associated with a dust bowl, it's also a matter of people losing their land, becoming tenant farmers, and eventually losing their land to the banks. And there's a famous scene in the book of the tractors, running in a line across the farms, turning over the soil and basically having mm-hmm. driven all of the people out.
Right.
So it's kind of it's not something new.
No.
What do people want to do? Well, you were talking about sustainable beef, which sounds like an oxymoron to me.
Uh-huh.
I just recently encountered it somewhere, but I can't remember what I read about. So what does this mean exactly?
Well, they're working that out. it's an effort by there's somebody that I know who's a leader of it in Kansas, who I've met through this project, mm-hmm. who has a bull farm. And they're trying to figure out the criteria right now. They've been going through open comment, but it's an initiative led by those in the industry.
Yeah, sure.
You know, there, I think those who are in this industry understand that they face real challenges, and so they need to figure out how to address these questions of sustainability. You know, last time I was there, the almost real burger, what are these things? Beyond Burger or
vegetarian.
Yeah, these new things that had come out had just made it to the market, and I was hearing all kinds of anxieties about that and how are, you know, cattle ranchers going to compete with this. There's a lot of initiatives going on, and there's a, you know, these are folks who understand that they have to respond to changes, both in, you know, that are socioeconomic problems of living in these small towns and in the environmental challenges that we face, because, you know, cattle are they eat corn. They didn't always eat corn. That's an important point. There's a discussion. Kansas is a site of the last remaining tall grass prairies, largest swaths of tall grass prairie, yeah, yeah. In the country and really around the world. And cattle have, there's a whole industry around bringing your cattle from, you know, they might be born in the South and then you bring them to the pasture lands of Kansas to fatten them up, and then you take them to the feedlots. But you didn't always finish the cow, quote unquote, finish these cows off at feedlots. That's a new phenomenon, feeding cows corn. They didn't used to eat corn. But corn is a water hungry crop.
Right.
And so there is a recognition that way of producing cattle is facing its limits and its ends. So there's a lot of, that's what I'm tracking is different response. Part of what I'm tracking anyway, I mean, there's lots of things I'm looking at, but part of what I'm tracking is responses to that and how people are, you know, and this is one of the initiatives.
Yeah. Are there any crops being grown around these areas you're looking at, or is it just ranching?
No. It's, you know, you think of the Oklahoma, though, I don't know if you know the play Oklahoma, and there's that song about how farmers and ranchers don't like each other.
Yeah.
Because the ranchers want, the farmers want fences and the ranchers don't. They want open range. Yeah. And in this part of Kansas, I've taken photos before that will show, you know, a lot of people think that Kansas is flat, but it's not. You know, there's the Flint Hills. And the thing about the Flint Hills is that they have flint in them. And so no one has ever managed to plow up those hills to make for agriculture there. And on, you know, as we know, on a day like today, it's really windy out, you know, on the tops of hills are the windiest places. It's very bad for agriculture. The water would blow away. The reason why there's not a lot of trees in Kansas is because the wind blows so strongly. It's not just a matter of precipitation. Mm. It's a matter of the wind whipping away whatever precipitation there is. So on the top of these hills, you can't get corn or wheat or anything to grow. So it's always been cattle land. Let me say, the question of temporality in Kansas is an important issue because, you know, there weren't always cattle in Kansas. There were buffalo. Before there were ranches, there were native peoples, which is a whole other.
And I want to talk about that a little bit.
But I want to just note that because, you know, how we talk about time is an issue in Kansas. So the top of the hills are the cattle lands, and then the bottom lands, you often get all these creeks running through them, and that's where you get the rich agricultural soil. And so the farmland happens down there. Uh-huh. So I've been interviewing both farmers and ranchers, and that has been illuminating to get both of those perspectives. They're very different.
What do they say? So tell us about that. What do they say?
Well, the ranchers are much more, I think, prone to be those who are in alliance with the environmentalists. So they're
really
because for them, preserving the prairie, quote unquote, is the cattle are a part of preserving the prairie as long as there's a kind of saying, you know, leave half, you know, let the cattle eat half and then leave half. Now, you're under those conditions, you're never going to get the iconic, you know, 14 foot, you know, little and big blue stem prairie grasses that everyone associates with. You know, if you read Little House on the Prairie and you read about, you know, people who couldn't see above them, you know, themselves through the grass, that's not going to happen. But you will, you can get a pretty diverse ecosystem with cattle grazing the land. And so You know, it's much more to be said about that point. And actually, that relates to questions around management of the Tallgrass Prairie Park, where I've heard, you know, these various discussions about, should we bring the buffalo back? Are they better? You know, the cattle. But farmers, they're much more likely to be concerned about things like the Waters of America Act, you know, the famous, you know, Obama. You know, one of the reasons why farmers in Kansas were voted for Trump is that they thought that Obama's environmental policies, quite specifically the Waters of the America Act, had gone too far. That now they were being regulated. You know, every little ditch they built, you know, they dug to get water, because there's not a lot of rainfall in Kansas. So one way that you collect water is through digging out and creating your own ponds. A lot of these are. Yeah. Are human-made ponds, and then the government now said, well, we want to regulate all those. And if you happen to have this, there's this one little fish in Kansas that's protected, and if you happen to get one of those fish in your pond, then, you know, you're in trouble, because
you're out of luck.
You're out of luck. So farmers are much more, I think, have been affected by the EPA policies, although that affects the ranches as well. There is this one little tiny fish in Kansas that, you know, that is protected, that if it's on your land, then there are, you can't do certain types of things within so many feet of that stream or whatever. So those are broad. That's not to say that there aren't, there are say farmers in Western Kansas who have been, and not just farmers, but you have folks at the community colleges who are building programs around irrigation technology, you know, trying to, you know, basically create what they've been calling, you know, this term precision agriculture gets used. You know, so the answer is, if the water's running out, then let's monitor every drop and make sure that we're not wasting a drop of water. And so farmers in that part of Kansas have been leading that effort, because they have the biggest problem when it comes to water. If you go across Kansas, the water, the amount of water you have decreases drastically. The amount of water that rainfall there is decreases drastically from eastern Kansas to western Kansas. So you're talking about two different states, really, when it comes to environmental conditions. Eastern Kansas gets, you know, something like 30 some inches of rain, and western Kansas something like 10 to 15. So,
Yeah. Well, we talked earlier about the hypothesis, the theory, the argument that rain follows the plow, and the 100th meridian, right, runs right down the middle of Kansas.
Yeah.
And historically, rain-fed agriculture has moved back and forth depending on the rainfall. Can you tell us a little bit about that, a little more about that, or did I just say everything?
No. Well, so eastern Kansas doesn't have to worry nearly as much about water as western Kansas does. And I think that's that there is a people often talk about, we talk in California about how there's northern California and southern California, and they're two different states. Well, same thing applies in Kansas. In fact, people talk about three different states. There's eastern Kansas, central Kansas, and western Kansas. And it's true that, you know, they feel like very different places. One of the questions, I know this is not your question, but I'm just going to say this now. Every time I talk to people and I interview them, my first question always is, what is prairie? And are we in a prairie? And you get out to western Kansas, and that's an interesting question, because they are less likely to tell you you're in prairie. They're more likely to tell you you're in the high plains. And it is very much about, you really have no trees out there. I mean, it is a very different place, just visually. And you do have this sense of just this, it's just a big sky. So the folks in eastern Kansas don't worry so much about water. And the folks in, and they get on their environment, you know, like there's also an urban rural split here, where the rural part of especially western Kansas thinks that all the environmental movement, you know, people on the eastern part, you know, they don't understand, and they're, you know, they don't get the challenges that are faced in western Kansas. But so that is also why irrigation is a big deal in western Kansas and not in eastern Kansas. So you might know about the center pivot technology.
I was gonna ask, right?
Yeah. So anybody who's flown over the country and looks down and see those circles, that is a sign of an innovation in irrigation technology from about the 1960s. We started to have, you know, it used to be that people would just bring pipes out into the fields and basically flood them with water, but that was very inefficient. And then they came up with this center pivot, you know, where the water basically comes out of these sprinklers that are on a circle that run around the field. And now you have what you call drag and drip. So instead of shooting the water through a sprinkler, you have a pipe that or a hose that comes down and drips onto the plants. Uh-huh. But that you see in Western Kansas and not in Eastern Kansas. So the real urgent water problems of the state are in Western Kansas. And in fact, I don't know if listeners will remember, around this time last year, especially in March of last year, we had the big epic floods. When I flew into Kansas, when I was in Kansas in March of last year, the Missouri River was over its banks. And I ironically had gone to talk, I was there partly, I biked to Topeka, Kansas to talk to folks in the water office, in Kansas about drought, but here we were in a flood. So, one of the things we talked about was the longstanding proposal to build a pipeline from the Missouri River up 3,000 feet, 500 miles to Western Kansas to deliver. The problem is not enough water. The problem is the water is in the wrong place. That's the argument that people would make.
That's what one always hears, right? It's up in the Arctic, and we need it down here, so we'll get icebergs.
That was an actual proposal.
Yeah, but I don't know how you'd get an iceberg to Kansas. That's the only thing.
You melt it and put it through a pipeline, you know.
And there's the pipeline from British Columbia. I mean, there are all kinds of, you know.
There's always going to be a technological solution.
Somebody's going to think about that. You mentioned this difference between the prairie and the high plains, which actually I had not been aware of, you know, and I was just thinking about High Plains Drifter, that great Clint Eastwood film. It's not about agriculture.
Okay.
What's in a couple of minutes before we have to take a break?
Yeah.
Tell us what's the difference there.
Oh gosh, I wish I could give you an answer. I really like this question. What is prairie? One person said to me, the prairie is a little lilt in the land. It's a poetic thing for some people. I mean, the prairie is like America. The prairie is Little House on the Prairie. Prairie is it's an iconic thing in the American imaginary. High Plains for those who live in the High Plains, they're very attached to the High Plains as a thing. I'm yet to really understand what the investment is in high. I mean, it literally is high. I mean, it's on its way to the Rockies, so it's much higher. It's about 1,500 feet higher than the center of prairie in the Kansas and the Flint Hills. But you know, it's a question that I've been asking, and it is something that means something to people that I've been trying to figure out.
Altitude and attitude.
Altitude and attitude,
Okay, well, you're listening to KSQD in Santa Cruz at 90.7 FM and ksquid.org, streaming on the net, and we're going to have a short break. So,
hello, this is Ralph Nader, and you are listening to KSQD, Santa Cruz's brand new community radio station.
Buddhism, Judaism, Baha'i, Islam, Christianity, Hinduism. Sound interesting? Faith Matters is a unique bi-monthly program that explores spirituality, life, and meaning with local religious leaders. We discuss areas of common ground and also identify distinct differences among diverse spiritual perspectives. Join us on the second and fourth Sunday evening of every month from 6 to 7 as we have thought-provoking conversations about Faith Matters on 90.7 KSQD.
KSQD thanks Sustainable Systems Research Foundation for supporting Sustainability Now. SSRF provides education, research, and advocacy for regional environmental quality and sustainability-related problems and solutions. For information, visit SustainableSystemsFoundation.org And thank you, SSRF, for supporting community radio, K-Squid 90.7 FM.
You're listening to Sustainability Now on K-Squid 90.7 FM. This is Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest this week is Professor Jenny Reardon from the Sociology Department up on the Hill. And we're talking about Kansas and about Jenny's research project, Biking Around Kansas, talking to people out there. For most of us, well, I won't say for most of us, but most of us only see Kansas from a height of 30 or 35,000 feet. We were just talking about the they're not crop circles, they're irrigation circles. And I've noticed over the years how more and more of them are turning brown because they're sort of being abandoned, it seems like. What's the prospect for the Ogallala Aquifer? I mean, we keep hearing that, you know, it's going.
Yeah. And, yeah, that's something I've been asking people about, and there's not an easy answer to that. There's the Kansas Geological Survey has about 1,000 test wells in Kansas, and you know, Kansas, which is known as a state that you know, famously decided to not teach evolution or to say, look, you can teach intelligent design in your classes, is, you know, some people think of it as being anti-science. But when it comes to water, it has the most data about water than any other state in the country. And it's very focused on understanding what's going on with the Ogallala Aquifer. And so they have these test wells. And they recently released some data that, you know, prior to them releasing the data, I think everyone thought, okay, the water is running out now. And now there's new data that suggests, well, maybe there's a little more recharge than we thought, you know, from water that's coming down, you know, rain that's coming down now and percolating in, you know, which raises questions about how do you model what's going on in the Ogallala? How do you trust the models? You know, how do you measure this water, which is part of what I'm getting into with folks about issues of trust, who trusts who. And that's actually one of the issues is, you know, you need to have farmers and ranchers trust the data that's coming out, and you need them. One of the issues has been there's a lot of resistance to the state coming in and telling people what to do, and Kansas is one of those places. And the last governor, not the last government, but two governors back, Brownback, who you may know about, who went into the Trump administration. One of the things that he did, and Brownback is actually, people think that he had an important influence on Trump's tax policies. I don't know how many people will know that Kansas had a very radical change in its tax policies and cut all these taxes and led to kind of a disaster for the state. Yeah, it was a little bit of a disaster for the state.
It was supply side economics, I remember now.
Yeah.
Was that Brownback's idea?
It was Brownback. Yeah, and Trump picked that up. So, but one thing that Brownback did do that maybe had a less damaging effect on the state was he did a water vision. He had a water vision policy where he then went around the state and talked to farmers and ranchers about what their vision of how water should be used, knowing that, I mean, it's been known for a long time that if the water runs out in Kansas, it's a big problem because agriculture is a huge part of the economy in Kansas. And so the state understands that it needs to do something about this, but it also understands that it can't just go in and tell its people what to do. So it did this. We want to listen to you. We want to hear what you have to say. And what came out of that is that they came up with this thing called the LEMAs, which I've been hearing about, which is Limited Enhanced Management Areas, which basically is a way for the state of Kansas to give local communities more control over their water policy. They could decide. So I don't know how many details you want to get into. Water policy can go many routes, but people were given, like, you dug a well first in. The water policies come from California, which is
first in line,
whoever dug the well first has priority. It doesn't matter whether that makes any sense or not agriculturally, environmentally, but the first person in gets the rights. That was the policy. So the idea that you could have community control over the water is a new idea. But the only way it was going to work is if the community itself decided, you know, that we want to do that. We could technically, according to the state, we are licensed individually to draw more, say 30 inches a year of water out of this, out of our well, but we're going to voluntarily dial it back to 17 inches. And we collectively as decided as a community, we were going to do that because we don't want to see the end of our industry here in this generation.
Does the community then also allocate amounts of water depending on, you know, individual farmers' needs or something like that, according to acreage? I mean, is it ultimately, it sounds like a controlled access commons. That's not what it's called, but, basically a community regulated resource operation, which everyone has to cooperate in terms of how much they use. But I mean, what happens to someone who violates the...
So it becomes, it's community decided, but then the state then has the authority to enforce it.
Got it. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like property rights and it's enforced by the state. It's a...
Sort of,
it's kind of like a permit sort of system.
You technically still have your property right.
Yeah, but you don't... take the full amount, right?
Something right. You like voluntarily. Yeah. I'm a little unsure how that affects the actual property right. Those are things that I'm working out of the details of that stuff. But this, in general, that's what's happening.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty interesting. Oh, let's talk about what was Kansas before it was Kansas. Who lived there?
So Kansas, is a plains state where plains native peoples live there. There were a lot of buffalo in the part of Kansas I was talking about, the Flint Hills. And so it was an important site for, native peoples for that reason. It then became, a lot of the forced migrations of native peoples out of the South and the East and pushing nations like the Ka out to Kansas. And then, so in the 1800s, you had the Ka were a big presence in Kansas, but there were other native peoples there as well. And then in the 18, with the Santa Fe Trail, things began to really change. And people started going through Kansas to get to California. And, there's a whole complicated history here, but, that's when you get the Methodists coming out and saying, we're going to civilize, quote unquote, the Ka, and we're going to build a mission, and we're going to teach them agriculture. Because of that, the idea was that a civilized people would not be nomadic. Right, they wouldn't move around. And so the idea was to teach them agriculture so that they could settle down. And that was a huge fiasco. It failed utterly. And actually, interestingly enough, so the Ka end up getting forced onto smaller and smaller bits of land as, quote unquote settlers, built into that word itself is the ideology that if you settle, you're a civilized person.
Yeah.
As more and more of these settlers come and want to, this is prime agricultural land in this part of Kansas.
Uh-huh,
It's east of the 100th meridian.
Yeah.
It has rich soil. Kansas was, if you go way, way back, what was Kansas a long time ago?
Well, it's an ocean.
It was an ocean. And then the Rocky Mountains come up and the winds that are blowing from the west, I told you the winds blow from the west, was blowing the soil off of the Rocky Mountains onto Kansas. So you ended up having very rich soil in Kansas.
Yeah.
That's why, some of the best agricultural lands in the country were in Kansas at one point. And so once people figured out it wasn't the Great American Desert, there was a time in the 18th century where, famously Lewis and Clark said, okay, anything west of the Missouri River is, no man's, quote unquote, it's the Great American Desert. But that was soon discovered, of course, to be, not true, especially in eastern part of Kansas. So as more people discovered that, and also the other thing I should say is that Kansas was a key battleground state over slavery. Okay. And so Kansas became a focus of settlement, quote unquote, as the larger battle in the United States was happening over whether or not slavery was going to reign. And this is prior to the Civil War and the years prior to the Civil War, when Kansas was coming into the Union. Folks, abolitionists from the East Coast, took Kansas as a battleground and sent people out to settle Kansas. Yeah, yeah. To make it a free state. But what we often do is celebrate that part of Kansas, but we forget that in the name of that form of justice, we basically created this other huge form of injustice where we pushed Native peoples off the land, and then they went to Oklahoma, which at the time was called quote unquote Indian country. Mm-hmm. I have an old map of Kansas where you have Nebraska, Kansas, and then underneath of that was Indian country. So now the Ka are based in Oklahoma. But recently, 10 years ago, the Ka bought back land, you know, so they have money from casinos now, and they bought back the land, some of the land that was the former site of the mission in Kansas. And so there's this interesting return now. Kansas is one of, maybe the only state in the Union where basically all the Native peoples were pushed off. You know, Nebraska might be another such state, but places like North Dakota, South Dakota still have, you know, a pretty large presence of Native peoples, but in Kansas they really were pushed pretty much entirely out. But now in the case of the Ka, they are returning. But by the 1870s or so, basically you have no Native, very few Native, maybe the Potawatomi have a very small, still had a very small reservation in Kansas, but most of the Native peoples had been forced into Oklahoma. And so, you know, there's a whole other discussion to be had about how that affects, you know, contemporary Kansas that still lives on in people's memories about Kansas. I mean, I've been through many towns where they have Old Settlers Day, and basically history begins in 1856, you know, when Kansas became a state, and that's what's celebrated. So this is still an ongoing legacy of that, you know, forced removal of the Native peoples off the land.
Every American state has its own peculiar version of nationalism.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And its own creation history. I mean, if we weren't the United States, what a mess this place would be.
Yeah.
The other thing, the other thing that I wanted to bring up, and maybe after the break we can talk a little bit more about politics, was that in 1987, two academics at NYU in New York, Frank and Deborah Popper, published a paper. They were observing the depopulation of small towns across the Great Plains, and I guess the High Plains too. And they proposed letting it revert to grasslands, and they call it the Buffalo Commons, you know, basically bringing the buffalo back. I thought when I first heard about it that it was a sort of fascinating idea, and of course, it was widely ridiculed at the time. How could you possibly, and what happens to all the people? Anything like that going on right now?
Yeah, no, I've encountered many a buffalo in Kansas, and they always have an interesting story, the buffalo do. I could regale you with buffalo stories for the rest of the night. But
well, just tell us one.
Tell you one. Well, I mean, maybe the most important one. Which one do I want to tell? I'm going to tell this one. So outside Garden City, very important place in Kansas, home of the one of the largest slaughter houses, or they don't call it that, beef packing in the country. A very diverse place, actually, too, because of the workers that have been brought in to work at the plant. Yeah. It's on the Arkansas River, and it's also beyond the 100th meridian. And at the turn of the century, back in the turn of the front into the 20th century, so 1910 or so, the U.S. government was trying to get people to settle that part of Kansas because it was hard, you know, it didn't have as much rain.
Yeah.
And in order to prove up, as it were, you needed to, you know, to get your homestead and whatever, you needed to plant some trees. But the question was, I'm going to be getting to the buffalo here in a minute, but the question was, well, what trees could you plant in this part of Kansas that could grow so you could prove up and get your homestead? And so Teddy Roosevelt was president around that time, and he also believed that trees were civilizing, a civilizing force. A civilized people has trees. This is the origins of Arbor Day.
That sounds very Germanic.
Yeah, right. But this is the origins of Arbor Day. And so the federal government establishes a national forest in this part of Kansas and plants thousands and thousands and thousands of trees. Between 1900 and 1915 or something like that, thereabouts. And I might not have the exact dates right, but around then. And they all die except for 20. And actually, I made a special. So then I wanted to make a special mission to find these trees. Like, can I still find them? And that is the source of a very interesting long story. One thing I then came across as a result of trying to find those trees was a buffalo herd, because after the trees died, the idea was, well, we can bring the buffalo back. And this was something that, you know, again, it's part of that, that going back to that kind of iconic idea of what the West is, we should have our buffalo. And so they brought back this herd that, you know, the buffalo don't like the San Sage Prairie very much. I mean, they like Western Kansas. Uh-huh. I mean, sorry, uh-huh. Eastern Kansas, the Flint Hills, because they have all that rich prairie grass. But when, once you get to the Western Kansas, San Sage Prairie, you know, they would have passed through there, but they wouldn't have stopped. They would have, you know, it would have been like you or me trying to get through Kansas. You know, they're like, we want to go to the rich prairie grasses. But yeah. No, they got stuck in the sand sage prairie. So one day I tried to bike out to see these trees and I got stuck because there's sand. I mean, it's called sand sage prairie because there's a sand, and bikes, you know, quite classically don't go over sand very well. Yeah. So then I encountered someone who was the range manager of this piece of land in Kansas, and they offered to give me a ride out. And it was just turning from summer to fall, and we had to take the feed out to feed the buffalo because they could no longer survive on the sand sage. So we're like, you know, driving out in a truck to these buffalo, and here comes this huge herd of buffalo like running towards us as if we were like on the, it's like the Wild West, you know. And one of the things you learn growing up in this part of the country, or if you've ever gone to San Francisco and to the Golden Gate Park, is you don't get close to the buffalo. You're supposed to stay like, you know, 200 feet or 1,000 feet away or whatever. But no, not in this case. The buffalo ran right up to our truck, you know, and I could have like put my hand out and touched one. But so that buffalo herd has been there for a long time, and he learned a lot about buffalo in that trip, which I could tell you more about, but I know we got to take a break.
Yeah, you're listening to KSQD in Santa Cruz at 90.7 FM, your ink spot on the dial, and KSQD.org on the internet. And here comes a message.
Everyone, I'm Linda Berman Hall, founding host of A Cutting Edge. Every Sunday at 7:30 on KSQD 90.7 FM, one of our co-hosts interviews UCSC researchers about the lectures, book signings, conferences, or performances that they'll soon be sharing with the community. Learn the inside story here on KSQD 90.7 FM.
You're listening to Sustainability Now. This is Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest tonight is Jenny Reardon, professor of sociology at UC Santa Cruz. We've been talking just now about buffalo in Kansas. Isn't there a buffalo on the Kansas state seal? Or is that some other state? I don't remember. It doesn't really matter.
You would think I would know.
Well, yeah.
I know, but there's some wheat. I think there's wheat on the Kansas state seal. But anyway.
Well, that makes much more sense. Yeah.
There might be
maybe it's Colorado. Anyway, you mentioned Thomas Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas, published in 2004. And he went out there to try and figure out why the people of Kansas were voting against their economic interests for Republicans. In those days, I think we used to think that people voted their economic interests rather than their beliefs and fantasies and rages, as I think we're coming to think about now. But what did you find in terms of sort of the sense of economics, you know, because you talk about globalization and financialization in the description of the project, and
Yes. Well, yes. Yeah, so one of the things, I mean, in terms of globalization and financialization, one of the things I've been really interested in is the history of banks in Kansas.
Right.
They weren't
there. Agrarian populism. Yeah.
Yeah. And they weren't there before. How these new techniques of I actually spent a day on the training floor at Goldman Sachs and talking. Interestingly enough, I met the person who is in charge of commodities training at Goldman Sachs, and he knew about the same snowstorm I did in Kansas that killed off a bunch of cattle, and was very interested in what I was doing because it turns out that what actually happens on the land still matters, but. Because of financialization, you know, the ability to manipulate prices and, you know, it used to be that what would happen is you would, if you were a farmer and you wanted to figure out when to sell, right, you would call the local co-op and say, hey, what are the prices today? Now you have an app on your phone and any minute, you know, you could look and there's a different price. It's changing all the time. And one of the things I've heard from farmers is that that adds a whole level of stress for them, you know, like, when should I sell? When should I not? The volatility of the market is much more extreme than it used to be mm-hmm. when you were, you know, and that the level of complexity around financial technology, you know, technology has always been a big part of agriculture. The plow we think about, right. But algorithms we didn't think about. And now it is a big part of a farmer's life. And it's increased the stress because there's so many different decisions points for you. You always are thinking, should I sell? Should I sell? Should I sell? Do I get crop insurance? You know, do I buy futures? You know what, you know, there's all kinds of new financial instruments that didn't used to be there, that are, there now. And, globalization, of course, is important in all these. Most recently, the renegotiation of NAFTA. And one of the things that I have been hearing is that, you know, of course, everyone's talking about this too. Farmers were none too happy with Donald Trump's renegotiation of NAFTA. It threw them into chaos. So one thing that you don't want if you're farming is more sources of uncertainty.
Yeah, sure.
The weather is already a source of great uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that I've learned from the biking. We haven't talked so much about that aspect of this project, but one of the things that I get out of biking is just understanding just how precarious the land and the weather is. And you could go from a beautiful sunny day to a thunderstorm with the power of a hydrogen bomb, you know, like within an hour. And if you don't see it coming, I've had to learn how to deal with this. I'll just tell you one quick story about that. The last time I was, when I was out there last spring, there was a projected, maybe this was this last time, there was projected hailstorms. And I wrote to I texted my best friend, Angela, and I said, she said, you know that there's a big hailstorm coming and we might get 2 inches of hail. And I said, I said, are you home? Can you bail me out? And she wrote back and she said, not in a hailstorm. I was like, oh, right. Even in a car, that is not a good idea.
Yeah.
But the weather is really precarious. And so then if you add on the financial world onto that, you're just doubling, you're increasing the levels of uncertainty. And that's a real change that's driving, you know, some people out of agriculture. You know, we've had enough of this. It's but the renegotiation of NAFTA did not win Trump any supporters.
What element of that does it have something to do with corn or something?
Well, part of it was the trade wars with China.
With China, too. Yeah.
So it meant that, you know, this was a big news story about a year ago, the way in which farmers in this country were losing a lot of money because of the tariffs. And, you know, the story I was hearing is, yes, they're giving us subsidies, but, you know, there are lobbies that, you know, they're strong, as you may know, they're strong lobbies for particular crops, not all crops. So wheat still has a strong lobby, but I can't remember if it was corn or soybeans. They only gave a penny, and you know, as a subsidy, and folks said, you know, like don't even insult us with this penny. So the subsidies did not make up for the losses that the farmers were seeing because of the trade war with China. And what I've heard is that the renegotiated treaty, many of them see as being no better than NAFTA. So we just went through a year and a half of chaos. And threw us into a recession, an agriculture, what they're calling an agricultural recession.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me overall that, you know, in addition to the precarity of a farmer, your typical farmer, right?
Yeah.
And the uncertainty of financial markets, you've got all of these politics going on, right?
Right.
And people betting against you in the trading markets, and the commodity people buying short and right, sort of trying to suss out which way to go, right? And competition, it sounds pretty hellish.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh, and the other thing was that, you know, we encourage agriculture so much that we have these enormous surpluses,
right,
that something has to be done with them, right? And they get thrown out into the world market and screw that up more,
mm-hmm,
right? You know, and it would make there's always this thing about how are we going to feed the 10 billion,
mm-hmm,
but why the hell are we producing, you know, corn that's only going to feed sustainable beef, if that's what they're going to eat. I mean, I don't quite see how that's going to work out either. But,
yeah.
It's a crazy system, right? But
yeah,
it's so difficult to change it, you know, to do it in any kind of,
yeah,
rational fashion.
And we're a nation, you know, built on agriculture. You know,
yeah,
we're a nation that was supposed to be a bunch of gentlemen farmers, you know, out there producing.
Gentlemen,
you know,
in particular.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this is important.
Jefferson, yeah.
Yeah. To this Jeffersonian, yeah, notion of democracy. And so, you know, that's an important point. You know, farming is a way of life, farming as an American way of life. We have a lot of policies, old policies, new policies that are around protecting that, that don't always make a lot of sense in terms of trying to support lives and families.
And
you have deeply entrenched interest groups. Yeah.
Yeah, so. the old myths die hard if they ever die.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting. I mean, I talk about that all the time to my students, about the suburban house being a Jeffersonian dream,
mm-hmm,
right, that we replicated in so many. And now we've got urban agriculture and people wanting to have their little farms. And it's all part of this mythology in many ways.
Well, it's also interesting, you know, in the middle of one of the challenges of biking across Kansas has actually been trying to get food. You know, so in the middle of this huge agricultural district, you know, there's food everywhere, but none that anyone
none that
could
you eat.
You know,
yeah.
Here's a funny story about like how much I did not know before I started biking across Kansas. The first day I was biking and I saw what I thought were all this dead corn. And I thought, what's going on here? Like, why didn't the farmer harvest the corn before it died? And it wasn't, the corn was not meant for me though. It was
right.
meant for the cattle,
and
it was perfectly okay for the
right.
cattle to eat. So there used to be, you know, that when people lived on farms, they did have their own gardens.
Right, sure.
But now, more than often than not, you have what they used to call suitcase farmers, you know, people who live in town, who maybe moved the house that was on their farm outside of town into town. You know, actually, there's a lot of that. People lifted up the house, put it on a truck and moved it into town. You don't have these gardens that used to be there. And so I'm always really excited when I see that someone has a garden. Because in grocery stores is another big problem. There are not grocery stores in many parts of Kansas. So actually finding food is hard.
Food deserts out in the. Well, listen, we're just about out of time. So I want to thank you so much for being on Sustainability Now. Listeners, if you want to hear more about Professor Reardon's research by bike, you can hear a podcast by going to the Science and Justice Center website at scijust.ucse.edu. and searching for The Undisciplining Sessions. 2 weeks from today, my guest will be Nancy Falstich, Executive Director of Regeneración in Watsonville, founded on the principle that climate change is a social justice issue with local impacts and must be engaged with on a local level in order to build resilient communities. That's Sunday, February 23rd, 5 to 6 p.m. right here on KSQD 90.7 FM on your dial. And by the way, the station is rebroadcasting Sunday shows, both this one and Jill Cody's Be Bold America, from 5 to 6 p.m. on Tuesday mornings. From the 5 to 6 p.m. slot on Sundays in the 6 to 7 a.m. slot on Tuesday mornings, just in case you get up at 6 o'clock.